70 in 7. A win today, Hockey O'Clock. Original.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird es jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Nee. Mittendrin statt nur der Ball.
Das ist unglaublich, was die hier zelebrieren.
Nice move, another nice move.
Oh,
it's gone.
Oh, what a goal. It doesn't get any better than this.
One down, six to go. It is indeed the return of 70 in 7. Seven episodes dedicated to the great hockey life of the one and only Greg Holst. The 70 years of his hockey life, the 70th birthday that we're approaching in late February. This time around, we're going to talk about the times and the ages of 11 to 20. The teenage years of the great player, the great coach, the now great TV pundit that is Greg Holst. Coach, always great to have you back on Winter Day Hockey O'Clock talking hockey with you.
Tom Martin, yesterday or the first episode sure brought back some great memories, and I'm sure this episode will too, and some tough parts, but that's part of life.
This episode is kind of setting the stage for everything that happens afterwards. Like, no shit, really. Yes, it's the teenage years. And a lot of people do call the teenage years formative years. In what regard would you agree with that? That what happened in between ages 11 to 20 set you up for the rest of your life?
Well, I would say the good, the bad, and the ugly, all in one. Great times, tough times. Tough times on my parents. You know, when you're 16, 17 years old, you think you know everything, right? So, but it's all part of life, and it's part of the journey of figuring things out, just like anybody else. My case was maybe a little bit different in certain aspects, which we will talk about. And there's one particular that I will mention because I do think it gave me an edge of being a better hockey player. And we will get into that in a little bit.
Before we get into that at all, I'd like to listen to something that reached me via your dear friend, Lauren Satrak. He's your brother-in-law. He married your sister. I think the next part will be the one we do talk about that instance and how this happened. But he sent along a couple of messages. We heard from him in part one of 17-7. We're going to hear from him today again. We'll hear from him down the road in other episodes. This one's particularly interesting because, again, it characterizes you in maybe ways people haven't heard so or weren't aware of. Things that went down in the late 50s and the 60s. I suggest we just listen to what Lauren Satrak sent me and then we'll talk about it.
Greg Holst, born later. Because I met Greg later in life, I had to ask my wife Shelley what was he like in the early years growing up. She told me he was always organizing games, whether it was hockey, baseball, whatever. He would get on the phone, he would tell everyone there was a big game, and yet Greg would be the only guy that was organized so far for the game. He would tell all the guys that everybody was coming. And at that point, he would phone everyone, tell the same story, and they all would come to the game. It was always a great game, and in my mind, he still hasn't changed.
He called you a born leader, the one who organized all the games, and it might have started a little early. Maybe we could have played out that voice message in the last part too. But would you agree that during your, I'm going back to that again, your formative years, you were a born leader or became a born leader?
This is 100% true. And I talked to my mother about this and she brought it up a couple times. I would make the first phone call, usually to Bobby Turcotte, a friend of mine. And I'd say, hey, we got a ball hockey game going at such and such a time. So the first guy that I would call, of course, they're going to say, well, who's coming? And I'd list off 5-6 guys, but he was the first call. Oh, that's okay. I'm going to come. Then I call a second guy. He said, well, who's coming? And I would run through this on my 5-6 phone calls or however I was getting hold of them. And that is absolutely factual that I organized the game because I wanted to play and I needed guys and we had a great time. And when I think back to ball hockey or the football or the baseball, when I was playing ball hockey, I used to love going in nets and I was a hell of a goalie. We'll get into something else when I put the goalie pads on later in these podcasts. But yes, that is factual. I organized everything.
Let's start with your career or you trying to become a professional. We're still talking at the early teenage years. You were part of Saint Vital, but was there ever a time where you thought what I'm doing might be good enough to eventually make a career out of this and turn pro? Was there ever an instance in your early teens where you thought exactly that?
You are going to be shocked how I'm going to answer this. And the answer is 100% not. I can honestly tell you, even when I went through 2 years of university, I never really thought about the NHL. I even though I was a good player and you can see it by the numbers, especially my second year. Not until I went to the Kingston Canadiens did it ever really register. So I think in a way that was good. I was just playing, freaking it, enjoying the game. A lot of bullshit went on, obviously, with the French and English and Saint Vital up to 15. But nah, I never thought about it.
Then let's just try to set the stage again. Last time we talked about Montreal in the mid-50s, late 50s. It's 10 years later. We're in the 60s. Obviously, 20 years away from the end of World War II. It's the age of the, or the time of the baby boomers. Like, economy doing well. A lot of things going well for humanity and mankind. How had Montreal changed over the last 10 years or the first 10 years of your life?
Well, what happened was, you know, when you're young like that, you don't really pay too much attention to what's going on in the world. I mean, we didn't have the news on TV like we have today. And Dad was working two jobs and we always had enough food to eat, and I was playing sports and going to school, so life was good for me. But I played for Saint Vital up to 14 and a half before my 15th birthday. We had some really good years, baseball and hockey. So I created some really good friendships over those years, but then we moved to Point Claire on the West Island, which was primarily English back there. So we were coming from a French area and we moved to Point Claire when I was 15. Kind of heartbreaking because my girlfriend at the time, yeah, I had to leave her. I did hitchhike back many a day, but that kind of didn't work out. And I was kind of heartbroken, to tell you the truth, but that's also a part of life. So I kind of changed my view of women slightly. Plus, something else happened right about the time that we were moving to the West Island. I kind of got this skin condition, which became very serious. And I know a lot of people go through it growing up. So I thought it was just kind of normal stuff. But I'll talk a little bit about that and how that transpired and how I think it actually helped my hockey career. But moving to the West Island, English Park, we weren't accepted that well. They thought we were, you know, poor people coming from Montreal North. It was a little bit snooty, but we found our way and we had a great time there once we settled in. Once I got on the ice at the high school, Lindsay Place, things kind of changed. Actually, it's funny because Mom got a call. I wasn't there a couple of months or maybe early in the next year. They called my mom and they said, your son is trying to change the rules of the school. Mom goes, what are you talking about? So I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but you called me the organizer. I was trying to organize the whole freaking school. So that's kind of a funny story. And that is actually factual.
I just want to give people an impression or a kind of relation. You moved from Montreal North, and the last time we were lucky enough to talk to each other, I think I said that only 3.9% of all the people in Montreal North had grown up with their native language being English. And it's a 27-kilometer car ride from Montreal North to Pointe-Claire in the west of the island of Montreal. So basically around the corner, especially if you've grown up in North America. And you were right, indeed, that it's primarily English speaking. Apparently back in the day, already now 48.4% of all the people in the West Island do grow up as English speaking only. Interestingly enough, only 1.3% grew up speaking both English and French, according to the 2006 census. How did it affect you personally, socially, to go from a primarily French speaking district to an not almost exclusively, but primarily English speaking district?
Well, absolutely not a problem, because don't forget, I went to English school and on the streets, I spoke French. And baseball and hockey, I spoke French. So it was absolutely not a problem. I just didn't speak as much French anymore because I didn't really have to. But once I got into the school and once I started skating, Herb Medill was our coach. I met some of my friends that became lifetime friends, Bill Weatherall, Norm Rennie. I got in the club pretty quick. You know, I wasn't shy to meet friends. And like we had mentioned before, if you're really good at a sport, and I got on the ice with these guys and I could freaking play. So right away they're going, oh boy, let the fun begin. So when you're good at something, you're always accepted more and people kind of hang around you. So it wasn't an adjustment at all. Like I said, I did hitchhike back several times. I do have a funny story. One time I hitchhiked back to see Susan Clark was her name. And it was fifth or sixth time that I had gone back. And she told me, this is factual, that's because it's a funny story. Greg, I kissed Kirk McCormick. I said, you what? I kissed Kirk McCormick. I said, you got to be freaking kidding me. So that was it. I said, well, see you later. So I walked down from the veteran homes. It was kind of a rough part of town in Montreal North. I was down now. It was kind of evening and tears in my eyes, heartbroken. I said, damn. So I got down to Gouin Boulevard, which is down along the river. And tried hitchhiking home. I didn't make it home. So mom and dad, of course, were worried. I got to a certain point. I said, well, I'm going to go inside this apartment block, go down a few steps and sleep on the concrete under the steps, which I did. I got up in the morning. I got a hold of my parents. I think I had a dime. I made a phone call and they said, where the hell are you? So they came and picked me up on Gouin Boulevard after me sleeping on concrete steps in this old apartment block. I sat in the back of the car, did not say a word. Heartbroken, on my way back, Now, the next journey to find the next girlfriend had started.
Let me just stick with the sportive side of things. You started your teens by playing for Saint-Vital. And I don't think we properly established the hockey club enough. What was playing for Saint-Vital like? How would you describe the club?
Oh, it was fantastic because the top team was called Saint-Vincent-Marie. And Saint-Vital, we always go head-to-head with those guys. But these were fantastic years. But you have to remember, too, it was primarily a French league. One of the team had a few English guys. I was the only English guy, myself and Charlie Tapp, who got me involved in this. And they had nicknames for me. They called me the bloke farmer. But I do remember some of the games when we went up into the cafeteria or up into the restaurant after the game. It got nasty a few times, and I think pretty close to a scrap or two, just people, you know, yapping at me and my parents about being English and stuff. So there was a lot of that stuff going on, and that is actually factual. And I remember one time, I was probably about 13 or 14. His dad told me the story. They started putting pressure on me to score because if I don't score, we don't win. And I know for a fact my dad got wind of this. And he didn't say much because I didn't like mom and dad being involved with this hockey stuff. He went and told them, if you put the pressure on the kid like you're doing, he is out of here. I'm taking him right out of this program. So hats off to dad for doing that.
We're still talking about hockey days that have been gone for 50, 55, 60 years. Just to give people an impression of what went on in Montreal in those days, how was the junior hockey scene set up? How many, we're talking about Montreal. It is one of the hockey hotbeds on the planet. How many clubs were there? How many arenas? How many rinks? How many players? What do you still remember about the sheer magnitude of the sport in the city?
Well, hockey was the talk of the town. I mean, from Maurice Richard, the great Montreal Canadiens, you know, won two times five cups in a row. So the junior, the Ramparts, the Verdun, all the junior A teams. I didn't find out about the West Island junior B team until I got out there. But hockey was huge. Like the Montreal Junior Canadiens, they used to get drafted right from the Montreal Junior Canadiens and the Toronto Marlies right to the NHL team. It wasn't until years later that they started changing that because Montreal always had all the best freaking players. And I think that's one of the reasons they started having a draft. Montreal was always huge. Like I said, it was Saturday night hockey, Montreal against Toronto, Montreal against Boston. It was, if you look outside, everybody's playing ball hockey. And it's just a way of living. It's like a religion. Hockey was always huge.
Now, let me talk about the accessibility of the NHL. You elaborated the TV shows or talked about the TV shows that you were able to watch as a kid at a young age. And that there was always Hockey Night in Canada. Did that ever change? Was it only Hockey Night in Canada and the access to seeing one NHL game per year? Or did they tack on a couple another broadcasts? How available was the NHL during your teenage years?
Saturday night, 8 p.m., Hockey Night in Canada. Danny Gallivan, he was one of the best announcers ever. You could Google Danny Gallivan and listen to him talk. Foster Ewan, he was the guy more in Toronto. But Danny Gallivan, I remember that voice to this day. It was every Saturday night, 8 p.m., Hockey Night in Canada. And I watched a whole lot of those growing up.
You grew up with the NHL still being a six-team entity. But during your teenage years, the NHL had its very first expansion in 1967, and they doubled in size. Do you still remember that year, that time, or maybe even the announcement where they said, you know what, there are going to be six more NHL franchises?
Yes, I do remember that. And Scotty Bowman was coaching St. Louis. The California Seals had white skates. These are the things I remember. And now it became 12 teams. And I do remember the first year of expansion was the great goal that Bobby Orr scored when he flew through the air. And that was against St. Louis because they wanted one of those six to make the finals. Montreal did win, I think, in four. But I do remember that. Yes, I do. And it's funny, when I was, I'll talk about it later, I used to have red and white tack skates because I guess it was the French blood in me. So when I saw the California Seals come along wearing white skates, man, I thought this was just freaking unbelievable.
Just to give people an idea of how the league looked back then, we always talk about the original six, and they're, of course, well-known, the Montreal Canadiens, Boston Bruins, the New York Rangers, Toronto Maple Leafs, Detroit Red Wings, and Chicago Blackhawks. That's the original six. And then in 1967, again, the league doubled in size, and the Philadelphia Flyers, the Pittsburgh Penguins, the Minneapolis St. Paul franchise, the St. Louis Blues were added, and then the LA Kings and the California Seals based in Oakland, California. Interesting times back then, and obviously interesting for you too, because a league doubling in size, that also means double the amount of jobs available. Was that, I mean, you talked about it at the beginning of this episode, but just understanding or trying to understand, oh my, there will be twice the amount of professional hockey players now on the planet. Did that change anything in how you approach practice, playing the game, or were you still just focused on trying to have as much fun as possible with hockey?
It never crossed my mind for 1 second. And that is the absolute truth. Out junior B, university. No, I was just trying to live, figure out life. A lot of off-ice stuff was pretty freaking crazy because I was pretty wild. I was just figuring out life, going along. No, I never thought about it. It's quite incredible.
Take me through that time where the move was announced. How did it all go down? Did your parents said, hey, Greg, we're moving from our beautiful home in Montreal north to Point Claire on the West Island. How did that go on?
Well, we had when we moved from Rosemount from a small apartment to Montreal North, then we had a little bit of a bigger place. It was like a detached cottage. Like I said, we were there last summer. I took a picture right in front of it. And we had the little backyard. So we moved to a house now, which was bigger, a nice big backyard. And, well, there was never any questions asked. You just kind of do what you're told, right? But the only obstacle was my girlfriend. But that's part of life, and everybody goes through that. But me and Mom, we had gone out before we moved there, because the place needed some cleaning and some painting. And we would go out there, me and Mom, and do a lot of work on the place. So by the time we got in there, it was ready to go. And do you know who lives in that house today? My older sister lives in that house. And that's where I'm going to be staying in 10 days from now.
When this series comes out, you'll be staying in Montreal. You'll be vacationing in Mexico. So hopefully you'll be listening to this while walking on the beach and having a good time. But a move's really interesting, especially during those formative years when you knew that you'd move. And again, it's kind of only 30 kilometers, but it's also 30 kilometers away from the places that you knew, the friends you had, the club you were playing for. How much did Indeed change for you, especially on a social level?
You know, other than my girlfriend, maybe Bobby Turcotte, and Armand Lalonde, Rabai Landré, and Michel Dion, when I got into the high school, I made friends pretty quick. We got on the ice. I was playing good, met the coach. I had no trouble meeting guys, having fun. I wasn't shy. So once I got into the school, it happened pretty quick, you know, but I did, like I said, hitchhike back several times to see everybody back then. Not so much, say, the top players, but I had no trouble going into a new school. It's kind of funny because that's how Mike and Taylor, my kids, grew up. We lived in Canada. We lived in Florida. We lived in Austria. They would go from school to school, language to language. They had no problem with it either. So that's how I was too. I did not have a problem going into the now basically all English school and society on the West Island.
But was there ever a scenario where you'd keep playing for St. Vital, or was it clear and obvious that that would discontinue with your move to the West Island?
No, I think I stopped probably after Christmas. I don't know why I'm thinking February or whatever, because I had the second half of grade 10 at Lindsay Place on the West Island. So I'm not exactly sure if the season was over or almost over, but I did get onto the high school team because that's all there was out in the West Island. And I know we went to a tournament in New York and we had a bunch of games. That's all I remember. But no, that was basically goodbye to St. Vital.
How was that, saying goodbye to friends, coaches, club, not employees, but club members, ice staff, locker room staff, kind of people that you've known for years and where you knew, I'm probably not going to see you again on a daily basis, let alone on a yearly basis?
Well, Martin, that's kind of funny you're saying that. You're talking about trainers. And hey, we had one coach, one other guy, we had like 10 players. So you're saying goodbye to a small group, right? But the baseball we played too, and it's so much fun playing baseball. You know, was I probably a little upset with my parents and the move? I'm guessing probably a little bit. But once I got out there, yeah, I settled in pretty quick because you just do. You leave it behind. It was a great experience. Now the next experience, well, I've had lots of experiences. And this was just the next chapter of not only hockey, but life.
And you know what? We'll get to that next chapter in just a bit. We're going to take a quick break here on 70 in 7 Part 2. And we'll be back after this.
Win today, hockey, old bar. Do you enjoy listening to Win Today, Hockey O'Clock? If that is the case, then please rate the podcast. A 5-star rating or a review over at the podcast dealer of your choice would go a long way in helping to spread the good word of hockey. Win Today, Hockey O'Clock, the hockey podcast with real and open-ended hockey conversations.
Win Today, Hockey O'Clock.
Back on 70 in 7, the show dedicated to the 7 decades of the hockey life of the great Greg Holst. This is part 2. We're talking about the teenage years, ages 11 to 20. And coach, we've already had the distinct pleasure of talking about interesting things that have gone on. The first part of your second decade of existence happened or took place in Montreal. Nor you playing for St. Vital, Then the move to the West Islands happened. You talked about the social component that probably wasn't too easy, trying to acclimatize yourself, playing for a new hockey team. And this is probably where the time comes in where you started playing for a new high school team, a new coach, where you had to get along with new players. How was that, joining a new high school, joining a new club in a new district in Montreal?
As far as I recollect, it was not a problem at all. Like I said, if you're good at a sport, golf, home, baseball, hockey, especially hockey. Once I met Herb Adilla, coach, he was a great guy. I still know him to this day. He lives out there in Montreal. He's a great golfer. Meeting the guys, Bill and Norm and a bunch of guys, I fit in right away because I wasn't shy to fit in. When I got on the ice, everybody's looking at you because you can really play. So if I got on the ice and couldn't skate, it might have been a little more difficult, but that was not the case. But I remember that was the time, too, with the move. I'll just talk about this quickly. I did have some skin trouble, which, like I said, a lot of people do. But I had an extreme case. And I remember Mom took me to a Russian doctor downtown. She came with me one time. And after that, I went on, I think it was every Tuesday afternoon after school, I get on that bus. And I go all the way downtown. And I had this fierce look in my freaking eye because I knew what was coming. And he tried to treat me how he treated me, with knives. And then I would squeeze that bed, the bar, so freaking hard, I was almost shaking. And then he would put dry ice on me, they thought that would maybe help. I did that for many, many weeks. And I can honestly tell you, I would fight on a drop of a dime because it kind of toughened me up a lot. It was a tough time. And then I remember the following year when I was playing for the Junior B team, which I did make, which was a prestigious team. I used to go to the hospital, the Lakeshore, and Jimmy Roberts was a player for the Montreal Canadiens, number 6. And his sister was the nurse at the Lakeshore General. So I go to see her, and now they were going to try to put me in this bed like a big sun lamp, and they would actually freaking burn me. So I would leave there. I did it several times. I was freaking red, and I was like sunburnt. So now just think. You go on the ice. You got to put your gear on. Somebody hits you or taps you on the back. I would fight at the drop of a dime. So I think, as tough as it all was, it changed my character a little bit, probably to this day. But it also, I think, made me a better hockey player because I had one chip on my shoulder.
You were playing for the West Island Flyers, a Junior B team. I'd imagine there is a Junior A, but how was the landscape of junior hockey programs set up? What was the best division? Was it Junior A? If so, how many teams were there? How many in Junior B and so on? How does one have to think about that time in junior hockey in Montreal?
Well, I can't, excuse me, I can't remember exactly how many Junior A teams. You had the Ramparts.
Just a rough estimate.
Well, there's probably 10, 12, right? Of the Junior A's, the Drummondvilles, the Quebec Ramparts, the Verdun teams, so many teams. So the Junior B team also had a league of about St. Eustache. They had some French teams, tough fights, and a prestigious team. Town of Mount Royal had a great team. West Island Flyers was one of the top teams. That's where I ended up playing for. But before I went to training camp, a Cadillac pulled up at the house in Montreal in Pointe-Claire in front of our house. I think it was a Cadillac. And one of the Picard brothers, they were a big hockey family. They owned the Verdun Maple Leafs, Junior A. They came in, talked to me and Dad, Mom, and they wanted to sign me at 16. for some reason, you know, I was green to the whole situation. Dad just didn't have a good feeling about it, so we didn't sign. A year later, I think they ended up going to Junior B anyway, so it was probably a smart thing. So then I did try out for the West Island Flyers, and this was one of the top teams in Montreal.
Sorry, you can finish the story. I didn't want to interrupt. I just wanted to ask the next question, but if there's still some meat on the bone, go ahead, please.
Oh, no, there's lots of meat on the bone. So now I'm at training camp, 16 years old. Not many 16-year-olds made the team. I think Ricky Marsh was one other guy who made it. Early September, I think I had signed the contract that morning to play for the team. We had an exhibition game. The puck, I remember the play. The puck came into the slot, into the crease area. I shot the puck. A guy named John Davidson hit me and got me in the chin. So he knocked me out. Then I landed on my head. So I had a double knockout. I was out for quite a long time. I had a convulsion on the ice. I was bouncing around like I didn't swallow my tongue, but my body was flipping around. Maybe that's where I got some of my moves. I don't know. But Mom was watching this and she thought I was freaking dead. And all I remember was the blades of the stretcher taking me off the ice, pulling me off. That's the only sound I could remember till I woke up in the hospital, which was, you know, quite some time later for a knockout. The local hospital said, okay, take the weekend off. You got knocked out, whatever. So I go home and Mom says, no, we're going to take you downtown to a specialist next week. So we go to the specialist. And he puts all these 20 little needles in my head. Now they do it different. But back then, they'd keep your eyes open. They'd pop your eyes open. And I had all these needles in my coconut. They would test all the testing I did to see how the brain was, whatever. So I did the test. A couple days later, we go back down. This is early September. I'm 16. Mom goes in to see the doctor first. She comes walking out, and look on her face, I did not like, I actually remember this. She might have a different recollection. I walk in, he says, okay, Greg, you've had a brain concussion. It was pretty serious. You cannot play or do any exercise until Christmas. I'm going, holy shit, this is like 4 months. So that was a tough one. But that's the way it was, he said, because if you come back early and you get rocked a couple more times, you could be in trouble. You could become a little crazy or a little punchy. Well, we know the end. We know the answer to that. But that was one tough time.
We'll eventually get to your concussion history. And I know we joked about it in recent years, and I always go back to the autobiography of Ozzy Osbourne and him putting on page one of the autobiography. This is, I can't remember, not literally, but as far as I remember, I don't remember a whole lot because of the drugs and everything else, but what I do remember is in this book, and he always said, well, it's exactly the same with my concussions and all the other things, but I have to applaud you. There's still a lot of great stories and recollections from back then, and that's where I kind of want to intersect with a question, because nowadays if there's junior level play and junior hockey tournaments, there are agents and scouts and people what a snaggy for their organization everywhere. How did word get around back in your day that there's a talented player, that there's someone who needs to be watched? How did the players get elevated from one level to another?
Well, I actually, at that time, it never crossed my mind, but there obviously was scouts for the teams. Other coaches watch you play. Scouts watch you play. Don't forget, if you're a good player, word just gets around. So there was a lot of good players kicking around. So, and I knew who they were, the Dion Twins and Etonamount Royal. Well, I said, those guys are really good. So word gets around from player to player to coach, and they all had scouts. Everybody had scouts back then sniffing around too. Not quite like today. But if you're good, people find you.
Help me connect the dots from the West Island Flyers to the University of New Brunswick, because that happened during the season of 71-72. You weren't, or you hadn't even turned 18 years old, and you already played for a collegiate team. How did that happen? How did you go from the West Island Flyers to the University of New Brunswick?
Well, that's an interesting story too. I mean, my dad probably has the exact answer. The Quebec Ramparts were sniffing around too before that year. But for some reason, I didn't want to play in that league. I'm not sure. I don't know why. Could have been all the brawls, even though I could scrap and survive. But Dad took us down with Mom to UNB, and we checked it all out. And I'm sure we met the coach, Bill McGilvery. I can't remember exactly. But I did end up saying, you know what? That's where I want to go. That's how it came about. But also, when I was 15, Brown's University, which in the States, which is an Ivy University, they were in our house in the West Island talking about a scholarship, but you needed really good marks, which I didn't have because I didn't study hard enough. We had a connection through my sister, a friend who was at Brown's, and they came and knew I was a good hockey player. So it would have been a scholarship for sure, but you still have to have really good marks. And I did mention to Mom, she couldn't remember, but I think Cornell was sniffing around, and I think Vermont. But I know for sure Browns was in our house, showing me the program, showing me the pamphlets. And okay, that's just one other avenue. So here I am now. Browns was interested, and I end up going to UNB. So, oh boy. That first year in UNB, I was one wild stallion, boy. And I'll tell you a couple stories as we're moving on.
I'll get to the stories, but first I want to get to the trip, because the University of New Brunswick, located in Fredericton, New Brunswick, to this day, it's an 8.5-hour car ride from Montreal. So that's a fairly long ride. Or do you still remember going from Montreal to Fredericton?
Yes, I do. We drove down there, and it was, I think it's, you know, like you say, about 9 hours. I did fly home my first year one time in between. I think it cost like $15. That's a funny story too, but I remember driving down. We went to the campus. I know Dad paid, you know, for back then, quite a bit of money for me to do this. And, you know, it's not like we had extra money kicking around. If I could turn it all back, I definitely would have studied harder. But things happen in life, and off I went. And here I am at UNB at 17 years old and playing on a hockey team that's older than me. The guys are 20, 21. Some guys, I think, had even had some pro experience. So, the top team in the league at the time was St. Mary's, and they had a lot of those guys that played for Team Canada in the Olympics and that. So I'm gone now from Junior B, and the West Island Flyers wanted me to stay, and they wanted me to sign. They were actually pissed off at me because I went to UNB. I mean, it was my choice. It was basically none of their business, but that's how it is. When they have a good player, they wanted to hang on to me. They wanted to own me, and they were not happy when I went to UNB. But I went into a pretty good hockey program, and And as you see by the stats, I started to make my way.
You did improve dramatically. And there are indeed stats of your 2 years at the University of New Brunswick. First year, 18 games, 7 goals scored. Second year, 19 games played, 21 goals scored. You tripled your production. You also did better in assists. You had a lot more penalty minutes. I guess that comes with age too. But apart from the goals and the scoring output, was there ever a time where you felt that you do belong and that you do have a right to play at this level?
Well, the first year, I was pretty wild though. Like away from the rink, I was pretty wild. And the campus police are usually students. They go down, they control the parties, and they keep their eye on when we have parties or dues or whatever. And they'd be after me all the time. They say, Holstein, you got to freaking straighten up. Go mop the floor. You threw some stuff there. So it was actually funny because those guys would chase me all over the freaking place. And in my second year, I said, well, you know what? I started maturing a little bit. I became a campus police. I became one of the good guys. So it's funny how it all went. But in my second year, I got 6 goals one night. And it was against St. Thomas. And that was a hell of a night. Herb Medill, my coach at Lindsay Place, who I had mentioned before, he told me, hey, Greg, I got 7 one night. So we argued back and forth. That's kind of a fun story we have, even if I see him nowadays. But in the second year, you could see my stats went up. I was the leading scorer on the team with a lot of good hockey players that were older than me. But as far as thinking pro or anything else, it never crossed my mind. It really did not cross my mind.
But was there ever a time that someone reached out that told you, hey, someone from an NHL organization is now in the stand. Someone wants to know something about it. Was there ever just the slightest hint that there could be interest from National Hockey League organizations in you?
For me to answer that 100% honestly, I do not recall. When I was at UNB for 2 years, regardless of how good I was in the second year, I do not recall any of those conversations. And do you know who was on that team for 2 years? Donnie McAdam. Donnie worked in this league. And he coached in the NHL. He had a great career. He was owner of a minor league team. He's now working down in Hungary, right? Still.
We just talked about it the other day. We narrowly missed out, and you narrowly missed out on meeting him. We did a live recording of this podcast in Klagenfurt in mid-December. And of course, who coached the Hungarian national team for a pregame skate and later for some exhibition games in that arena on the same day we recorded a podcast? Of course, Don McAdam. Just shows time and time again how small Planet Hockey really is.
And you know, Donnie McAdam, he was kind of the leader on the team. And I stayed at Jones' house on campus with people in Jones' house. There was all these houses. And I played flag football for the house, and we had a great time. But Donnie McAdam lived off campus, and I remember he had a little house. And we had a couple of parties there. And I remember him being the leader and actually looking at me sometimes, especially in that first year, and just shaking his freaking head because I was wild. And he knew I could play, but I remember him. He was always kind of that mature leader kind of guy. I actually remember being in his house back in 1972. Unbelievable.
And he stayed true to kind of his roots with the University of New Brunswick, because eventually he ended up coaching the program or taking on the program as head coach. But for you, you only played 2 years of collegiate hockey at the University of New Brunswick. At what point did you know it's time to move on and become a Kingston Canadian? Because you moved from collegiate hockey, correct me if I'm mistaken, back to junior hockey? with the Kingston Canadians. What exactly were the Kingston Canadians?
Well, I went home after the second year. And I knew I didn't want to go back. So now I'm organizing my own life, hockey life. My parents had no idea what I was doing. I did not want to play in the Quebec League. The OHA, the Ontario Hockey League, for whatever reason it was, caught my eye. It was in my mind. So the Montreal Junior Canadiens that year moved from Montreal in the Quebec League to Kingston, Ontario in the OHA. They were called the Kingston Canadiens. And I said, wow, I'm going to phone them. I phoned the GM, Mr. Scheer, and I said, Mr. Scheer, this is Greg Holst. I'd like to have a tryout for your team. I remember this distinctively. He said, okay, Greg, good. Send us your resume and we'll take a look at it. So I sent them my resume and they saw something that kind of caught their eye. They said, they phoned me back and said, Greg, you are invited to camp. I didn't sign. You're invited to camp. So, wow. And I'm thinking to myself, holy shit, this is Major Junior. I better be in good freaking shape and prepare for this, because this is, we're going to be 60, 70 guys trying out, and this is going to be rough and tough. I remember going up to Kingston. Red Bonus was the coach. Stayed at the hotel there, the motel. I got out there the first scrimmage. And they had that contract out, I think, after the first freaking practice. Because I scored. I was flying. They go, wow. So it did not take long. It was within a day or two for me to sign the contract. And that's how I ended up there. That's how it happened. I had fear in my eyes and my mind, thinking Major Junior. But now, remember, I had 2 years playing with guys older than me. So what a way to prepare for Major Junior. If I could turn it all back, I would like to have 2 years Major Junior. Because that second year, I really could have taken off, I think. But University of New Brunswick was 100% the stepping stone for me to make the Kingston Canadiens, and the Kingston Canadiens now was my opportunity to play pro hockey.
The coach, an interesting one, Jack Red Bonus. He had just spent the 2 years prior to coaching the Kingston Canadiens in Sweden. Highly unusual at that time. He also had played in the NHL, so he had that experience under his belt. In what regard was he, and we were always talking about formative years, formative for the rest of your career?
Well, you know what? Back in the day, he was, I remember him. He was a great guy and he was a good, tough coach. And what the coach said, we did. There was never a question about questioning the coach, like, you know, nowadays they might. I remember that. We had a good bunch of guys, and I was looking up the stats today. Mike Crombie ended up playing. He was 16, 400 games in the NHL. O'Connell played 900 games in the NHL. He became general manager in Boston Bruins. Alex Forsythe became a first-round pick. Mark Sousa, first-round pick. This is on an expansion team. This was pretty freaking exciting. I did lead the team in scoring, and I had, you know, quite a few penalty minutes, because back then, you know, you have to have your scraps. You have your five, six, or seven fights. That was just part of it. And I remember Kingston. It was a great town. We all had a song. So every player on the team was given a song, and they would play the song on the radio. So because I had a nice girlfriend there and I had a girlfriend coming out from Montreal, my song was, and we all got a cassette of all the songs, and my song was from the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. And that was my song when I played for the Kingston Canadians.
See, now you made people, and especially the younger listeners, really aware of how long ago this is. You got a cassette. Young people don't know what a cassette is anymore.
Exactly.
Finishing off the 73-74 season and drawing closer to a major experience in your hockey life, but that will be part of the next episode. You being drafted in the 1974 NHL amateur draft. And especially considering how well the 73-74 season with you being part of the Kingston Canadians went, you never really trying to think about going professional, but was there a teammate? Was there maybe Jack Red Bonus? Was there anyone telling you, Craig, this is really exciting, the trajectory that you're on, this could lead to a career in hockey?
It could very well be, but I really do not remember. But let me tell you, something happened when I played for the Kingston Canadiens. Because if you see the stats, I missed a bunch of games. So we're out there in warm-up one game, and we light up to take our half-circle shots on the goalie. So I skate behind our guy, behind our players. I take my shot, and I skate behind. And I think it was Eric Brubaker. He wound up to take a slap shot. And it got me right in the eyeball. It got me in the eye. So, of course, down I went, and I am now in the hospital, and they do the tests, but before they test, they have to close both my eyes. And I was thinking it was a week, but I think it was about 2 or 3 days I had to patch my eyes shut to try to stop the hemorrhaging of the blood. Well, mom and dad get wind of this, and they drove all the way up from Montreal, which is about, you know, two and a half, 3 hour drive to see me. There I am. Of course, I've gone through a major concussion. I've gone through other injuries. And here they see me with two patches on my eyes. And I remember trying to figure out the food. They tell me, okay, at 12 o'clock is this, at 3 o'clock is this, at 6 o'clock is this. But I didn't quite follow that clock thing. So I'd be sticking my finger in the soup, in the yolk. I got to figure this shit out. This is whatever. But anyway, a funny story about it. They took off my patches a few days later, did my testing. It looked like the hemorrhaging. You know, am I going to lose my eye? How serious is it? Is the year over? Is my career over? Because a guy named Greg Neild lost his eye playing for the Toronto Marlboros. Lost it and ended up playing with one eye in junior, and he made the NHL. His name was Greg Neild. You could Google him. Anyway, it worked out well. It worked out well that I was back within a couple weeks. The eye didn't hemorrhage. It was a scary time, but I have a funny story on this. I brought the players a gift. So when I came back, Holtzey, welcome back. He said, guys, I have a little gift for you. What do you have? Well, Queen's University, and it's a nursing city, and it's a nursing university, and it was student nurse week when I was at the hospital. So I got the number of several girls. I think it was 19, but I think that's a little, let's say a dozen numbers of girls. And their phone numbers and their names. I brought it back to the guys. And I said, guys, here's a gift. Here's a list of 12 women. Holtzey, thank you very much. What do they look like? I said, guys, I have no freaking idea. I couldn't see them for 3 days, but I got you the numbers. And that is a true story.
Coach, we'll leave it at exactly this. We're approaching your age 20 season. Ages 20 to 30 will be the talk of the next episode, part 3 of 70 in 7. It will be about the NHL draft. It will be about you playing in the National Hockey League in the minors and, of course, making your way over to Austria. It's going to be a loaded episode, but for the time being, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for shedding some light onto your years, ages 11 to 20.
Thank you very much. Did you want to finish with that story before the draft when they flew me and Dad in, or do you want to continue that next time?
It's called a cliffhanger. We'll do it next time.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Martin. Brings back great memories.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn. Und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Die Fans stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh.
Nice move, another nice move. Oh, it's gone!